Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
National Car Rental has your back, road warriors, because we know you're picking up the pace, steering life at 10 and 2. You're hitting the road, and National's helping you get there with the confidence of our complete clean pledge. So skip the counter without missing a beat and choose any car in the aisle. National Car Rental. Go like a pro. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 7th of July, these are our main stories. The UN warns of a deadly freefall into even greater violence by Myanmar's military and calls on the world to stop supplying them with weapons. The company that operated the submersible that imploded on a trip to the Titanic, killing everyone on board, has suspended all activities. And
I learned this foundry was run by 76 black metallurgists, described as perfect in every branch of metalworking, and I learned some of their names.
How a pioneering iron-making technique that helped forge Britain's Industrial Revolution may have been taken from slaves in Jamaica. Also in this podcast, more than 60,000 Afghan women look set to lose their jobs as a result of the Taliban's decision to close beauty parlours. And the Netherlands hands back hundreds of looted colonial-era artefacts to Sri Lanka and Indonesia. Myanmar is being ravaged by military attacks on its villages and people. That's according to the United Nations, which said that civilians are in dire peril since the coup more than 2 years ago. The UN Special Rapporteur on Myanmar, Tom Andrews, said that more than 800 children had been killed since 2021 and that airstrikes had doubled over the past year. He added that the junta had managed to get hold of weapons worth $1 billion. Mr. Andrews urged the international community to act.
Number one, stop the flow of weapons into the hands of the junta and stop the flow of money flowing into the pockets of the junta. This is a very large military that this junta controls, and that is their strength as far as the junta is concerned. But it's also a vulnerability. It costs an enormous amount of money to equip and keep this military going. And so there is a vulnerability that the international community needs to address and exploit in order to stop the carnage that continues day after day.
To get a clearer picture of what's happening, I spoke to Sowin Tan, who's editor of the BBC's Burmese service.
The regime would be going into the villages when they said they are going after the armed resistance to them. It's an indiscriminate attack against the civilian population there, because for them, a lot of people are the enemies. So the casualties include a lot of children. They increasingly use the air power, which is indiscriminate, like, you know, civilians, children, women, everyone on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, if they're using airstrikes, it's proof that they have lost control of large parts of the country. That means it's a civil war, doesn't it?
It is, like, you know, we call it as a civil war since, because Myanmar is no stranger to the civil war. It has been kind of a civil war going in since independence, like 70 years ago. Previously, the fighting were mostly along the border, on the periphery. But since the military coup, that fighting happened in the center. So because the military is facing a resistance from widespread areas, like, you know, across the population, so whenever they go in, they can't move the troops easily on the ground. There is always the danger of being ambushed. So they increasingly resort to their superior air power.
And the UN believes $1 billion of arms have been shipped to the military junta. How come? Who's doing this?
You know, it's quite well known that Russia and China are the main providers of arms and equipment to the military. Like, you know, Russia is the main kind of provider of arms. That includes, like, fighter jets, attack helicopters, reconnaissance and attack drones, and other spare parts and equipment. Not only Russia and China, there are other players as well, like, you know, providing arms to Myanmar junta. But Russia and China, they are state-affiliated agencies and companies are providing those arms.
So where's this going?
The situation is really difficult, but the resistance is gaining ground. we could see in recent parts. They score some victories in the battlefields. So the resistance movement announced that 2023 could be the decisive year. They wouldn't win a battle outright, but then the tide would be turned. Like, you know, previously they were on the receiving ends, but now they are more battle-hardened. They acquired more modern equipment and weapons, but still military is still quite formidable.
So Win Tan, the editor of the BBC's Burmese service. Western military leaders say they're closely tracking the activities of the Wagner paramilitary forces and their leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, following their short-lived Russian mutiny. The leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, said Mr. Prigozhin was back in Russia. The NATO Secretary-General, Jens Stoltenberg, says the alliance has been keeping a close eye on Mr. Prigozhin's location.
What we can say is that we monitor closely where the Wagner soldiers are moving around and also where he is moving. We have seen some preparations for hosting large groups of Wagner soldiers in Belarus. So far, we haven't seen so many of them going to Belarus. And then we have seen Mr. Prigozhin moving a bit around. I'm not going into any more details than that.
Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, was one of the journalists invited to the presidential palace in Minsk for that press conference on Thursday.
It was quite an extraordinary event, really, Alex. I mean, Alexander Lukashenko went from moments of charm when he saw me, said, "Oh, great to see you, Steve, looking so young and healthy," to moments of nuclear saber rattling. But the central theme was events in Russia and the recent Wagner mutiny and the fate of Yevgeny Prigozhin. Now, Alexander Lukashenko, we are told, is the man who helped to broker a deal to end the mutiny. And under that deal, we thought Mr. Prigozhin had to leave Russia, exiled to Belarus, along with some of his fighters who wanted to go with him. We thought that that was the deal. But what was extraordinary today was that the leader of Belarus said, well, actually, Yevgeny Prigozhin is not in Belarus at the moment. He was in St. Petersburg. Maybe he's flown to Moscow. Maybe he's gone somewhere else. Number one. And number two, he claims that the Wagner fighters have not moved to Belarus, although he says that he offered them various facilities, various possible campsites for their bases, but they haven't taken up the offer. So we don't really know where that leaves the deal that was done between the Kremlin and Wagner. I asked Mr. Lukashenko, is the deal off? He said, no, the deal still stands. But the fact remains, there's no Prigozhin here, we believe, and no Wagner fighters yet. So what is happening? Once again, I have to admit, we don't know.
He said something quite extraordinary to you, didn't he?
Yes, he did. You know, we're talking about Russian nuclear warheads that the Kremlin says it's going to relocate to Belarusian territory. And there have been a lot of questions about whether Alexander Lukashenko would play any role in pressing the button. He said, I think a few weeks ago, God forbid that I should have to take the decision to use these weapons. So I said to him, hang on, these are not your weapons to decide to use, are they? They are Russian weapons. And he said to me, well, you know, look at Ukraine. The Ukrainian army is using NATO weapons, so why can't I use foreign weapons? And I said, hang on a second, we're talking about nuclear weapons here, right? We're not talking about pistols or guns. And he said, yes, well, nuclear weapons are weapons too. Quite an extraordinary little exchange there. I suspect that President Putin would bristle at the thought of the leader of Belarus actually being involved in pressing any nuclear button. From what we hear from Russian officials, you know, these are going to be Russian tactical nuclear weapons under the control of the Russian army in Belarus.
Steve Rosenberg in Belarus. The company that owned the Titan submersible has suspended commercial operations indefinitely. The vessel lost communications on the 18th of June. An international rescue mission was launched, but later found that all five people on board had died. Here's our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley.
It was all but inevitable that this announcement would come. Even before the Titan descended into the Atlantic, its mission to visit the wreck of the Titanic was plagued with safety concerns. The BBC has seen emails from the late chief executive Stockton Rush dismissing those warnings as baseless cries. In one email, he said, "I'm tired of industry players who try to use a safety argument to stop innovation." Mr. Rush died alongside four others, who each paid $250,000 for their place. Now Oceangate says it has stopped exploration and commercial operations.
our North America correspondent Sean Dilley. Most observers thought the world's second largest economy would recover from COVID-19, but the opposite has happened in China, with sluggish consumption taking the government there by surprise as people tighten their belts. At the heart of the challenge is a pre-COVID reliance on a bloated, in-debt real estate sector that's collapsing. Analysts are trying to calculate just how much impact a depressed Chinese economy might have on the many countries which rely on its growth. Our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell travelled to Shandong province in the east of the country to take its pulse.
This is the raucous sound of Zibo, a small city in eastern China, which is going through something of an outdoor barbecue craze. And if you came here and went for a walk around, you might think this clearly shows China really bouncing back economically following the COVID crisis. But actually, experts are saying it might be quite the opposite, that actually people are choosing a cheap, cheerful option rather than spending big on other items because of pressures on their family income.
This place is great for ordinary people. Recently, it has been hard to make money, but still easy to spend it. After 3 years of COVID, the economy is only slowly recovering.
University graduates are being especially hit by China's economic doldrums, with youth unemployment hovering at or above 20%. And there are quite a few of them amongst the diners and karaoke singers in Zibo.
Yes, I'm worried. There's a lot of competition. It's hard to find a job. All my classmates feel the same pressure.
The principal reason why those who have jobs here are reluctant to spend big is because they're nervous about their personal financial security. To see why this might be, we travel a few hours to the east, to the outskirts of a much larger city, Qingdao, where a property explosion hasn't matched real demand from buyers or renters. I'm looking up at an apartment block, and for the first seven stories, there's paint and there are windows, but then they stop on the floors from seven to what it looks to be about floor 30. There are no windows and the window frames are looking the worse for wear. Locals here have told us that on many of these huge housing projects, work just stopped. Apparently there had been interest in buying apartments in this area, but not anymore. We meet a woman selling cold noodles outside a housing estate where she doesn't have many neighbours. A couple of years ago, she bought a flat here. I ask if she's worried about its value collapsing.
Of course I'm worried, but what can I do?
If a household's main investment is a flat, and that investment now isn't worth what they thought it would be, that's clearly going to hit consumer confidence, making people more reluctant to buy stuff. And according to a local real estate agent, sales volumes have halved in the area in recent years.
Prices are down because the market is saturated. Too many homes were built, and it's hard to sell them.
Economists like Harry Murphy Cruz from Moody's Analytics think the huge Chinese economy has big problems at the moment.
China's economy is in desperate need of rebalancing. It's had that massive period of growth, big infrastructure building from massive uptick in the property market, but it's not a sustainable growth driver going forward. Look around the world, developed economies need households as a key driver of economic growth, and that's just not what China has at the moment.
The challenge for the government in trying to get Chinese consumers to spend more, even with cash handouts, is that once negative sentiment sets in, it can be hard to change.
Stephen McDonnell reporting from China. The chief executive of the energy giant Shell has told the BBC that poorer countries could again face surging energy prices if oil and gas are phased out before a green alternative is ready to replace them, while Sawan said he respectively disagreed with climate scientists who said firms such as his should accelerate the transition away from fossil fuels. He was talking to our business editor, Simon Jack.
The reality is the energy system of today continues to desperately need oil and gas. And before we are able to let go of that, we need to make sure that we have developed the new energy systems of the future. And we are not yet collectively moving at the pace that requires that to happen.
Antonio Guterres, the chief of the UN, said that it is economic and moral madness to continue to look for new oil and gas. What would you say to him?
I disagree with him, respectfully. I think what would be dangerous and irresponsible is actually cutting out the oil and gas production so that the cost of living, as we saw just last year, starts to shoot up again. Not to mention the fact that many countries last year, countries like Bangladesh, countries like Pakistan, because Europe could afford to import LNG, they took away that LNG from those countries, and children had to work or to study on the light of candles. I think if we're going to have a transition, it needs to be a just transition that doesn't work for one part of the world, but needs to be a globally responsible transition. And therefore, the voices of all countries need to count, not the voices of the few.
Everyone feels very relieved we got through the winter with the lights staying on. Are we being complacent about this winter and beyond?
I think there is a danger. Important to recognize, last winter, a lot of the reprieve came from what was a warm winter, and two, China's demand wasn't as high as it traditionally had been, which allowed a lot of the liquefied natural gas to actually be shipped over to Europe. One cannot depend on that as an energy policy going into the coming winters. And therefore, there is a concern that if we have a cold winter and energy demand in many other locations, including China, goes back up, then there will be a strain on resources coming here.
Are we going to get back to the spikes that we saw in the summer of last year?
I really hope not, but the tightness in the broader market, both for oil and gas, means that small shifts can have magnified effect. Last year, the overall energy production that was taken out because of the Russian invasion was 1% of global energy supply. That is what created the massive volatility of last year. And so if you get a similar 1, 2, 3% takeout of that production, then who knows how massive that volatility can be.
You're going to keep investing to keep that supply coming. That sounds to some people like a counsel of despair when it comes to the climate.
I would really hope not. My message would actually be the world has made a lot of progress over recent years, but we still have a mountain to climb to be able to get to where we need to get to. We are committed to the energy transition, but we are going to do it responsibly, and we have a fiduciary duty of care to our shareholders to steward their capital in the best way possible. That today continues to mean that a portion of it is going to go to oil and gas, a significant portion, as you rightly say. And at the same time, we will incrementally increase our renewable spend as and when those value pools emerge.
While Sawan speaking to Simon Jack. Still to come in this Global News podcast.
Hi there, my name is Nadine and I'm a humanoid social robot from the University of Geneva. My purpose in life is to help people by providing them with companionship.
Why the likes of Nadine blew the minds of attendees at the UN Artificial Intelligence Summit in Geneva. The Afghan Chamber of Commerce and Industry says more than 60,000 women will lose their jobs following the Taliban's decision to shut all female beauty salons in the country. The Taliban authorities earlier this week ordered their closure within a month. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan has more details.
The beauty salons were one of the few remaining public spaces accessed by Afghan women. Afghanistan's industry body said on average five women worked in each salon and they were the only breadwinners for their families. The Taliban have justified the decision, saying parents of couples getting married incur unnecessary expenses by paying beauty parlors. They also said the use of wigs and the eyebrow plucking were against the Islamic law. Secondary schools for girls in most of the country remain shut, and the Taliban have barred women from universities, parks and gyms.
Anbarasan Etirajan. The Netherlands is wrestling with the legacy of its colonial past. At the weekend, King Willem-Alexander issued a historic apology for his country's involvement in slavery. And now, the government has announced it will hand back nearly 500 artefacts removed from Indonesia and Sri Lanka during the colonial period. Almost all of them are from Indonesia. Our Asia editor, Rebecca Henschke, who's reported from there, told me more about the objects.
Looking at the ones from Indonesia, these include precious stone, gold and silver jewellery that was looted by the Dutch troops from the Balinese royal palace. These are known as the Lombok treasures. There's also precious statues from former Hindu kingdoms in East Java, as well as a krisk, which is like a sacred dagger, and a collection of art from Bali, the Pitamata collection. And these are going to be returned formally to Indonesia on the 10th of July, and eventually the Indonesian government is saying that these will go on display at the National Museum in Jakarta.
What's the situation that led up to this?
Well, the Indonesian government has been asking for a long time for these artefacts to be returned, and there's been a real wrestling with coming to terms with the Dutch's colonial history, legacy and impact in Indonesia. When these items are being returned, we've heard from the Dutch cultural minister calling this a historic moment, that this is for the first time that we're returning objects that they said should never have been in Holland. So quite a strong statement, and saying that this is just the beginning. They want to start a new period with their former colonies like Indonesia to create more cooperation in the field of research, exchange of museum professionals, instead of the old colonial legacy of looting items and taking them back and putting them on display in a museum on the other side of the world. But it is notable that there are many items that still haven't been returned. One of those is the famous human remains of the Java man, even though the Indonesian government has requested their return. And there's also a famous diamond that was taken, the Banja diamond, and that negotiation is still ongoing.
Rebecca Henschke. In yesterday's Global News podcast, we reported on a big UN summit on artificial intelligence starting in Switzerland. Around 3,000 experts from Microsoft, Google and Amazon, as well as universities and international organisations, are trying to find a framework to ensure AI is used for positive purposes. On the opening day of the two-day event, many unaware attendees were startled by the humanoid robots suddenly turning to look at them as they passed by. Even the biggest names in tech found the experience mind-blowing. Imogen Folks reports from the summit in Geneva.
Hi there. My name is Nadine and I'm a humanoid social robot from the University of Geneva.
Meet Nadine, the robot designed for social care.
My purpose in life is to help people by providing them with companionship.
She's the brainchild of Geneva professor Nadia Talman, who has already tested her out in homes for the elderly in Singapore.
People were very happy. They went by themselves to talk to Nadine. They were saying, "You are my only friend." They explained all the stories. They cannot talk to somebody else. They came to her to play bingo. It was very positive. So in this case, I think they are very useful.
Could Nadine be our future? The UN's International Telecommunications Union believes this kind of artificial intelligence could and should be harnessed for the benefit of humanity, not just in social care, but in rapid disease diagnosis, even in tackling climate change. But there are concerns too. That's why Peggy Hicks of the UN's Human Rights Office is at the summit too.
There are real problems with its ability to accelerate disinformation and enhance bias. So we could see ourselves going down the same pathway that we did on social media, which would be really regrettable, given that we now know much more about how to avoid it. But we also have to look at the impacts on the world of work and make sure we're training up people to do jobs that may get replaced. But we also have to look at those longer-term consequences in areas like lethal weapons and things where there really are real, important, almost existential risks to some of these technologies.
So although there are dozens of robots at the summit, it's not just a marketing platform. The UN wants rules around governance, guardrails to prevent abuse and ensure transparency and accountability. Thomas Lamanauskas, Deputy General Secretary of the ITU, believes industry will get on board.
I think one good aspect now is that you see the industry itself rising up, and the industry itself actually, in a way, calling for the regulation. So I think we need to use that window of opportunity now to really come together for that inclusive discussion and to say how we can work all in a sustainable manner so that we really use and utilize a very powerful tool for good.
But UN plans for global rules tend to involve long and painstaking negotiations. Meanwhile, the technology around AI is racing ahead. There is some consensus that good governance is required, but an agreement about what that governance might actually look like could be years away.
Imogen Folks. Now to a remarkable story. New research says enslaved metal workers in 18th century Jamaica were responsible for a technological innovation that helped make Britain the first industrialised superpower. The court process, which allowed wrought iron to be produced from scrap iron, has been attributed to the British ironmaker Henry Cort. But Jenny Bulstrode, a lecturer at University College London, found the idea had come from Jamaica. She spoke to Victoria Uwanhunda and began by explaining how the technique transformed Britain.
Within a year of the 1783 patent by Cort, British MPs were saying that this innovation was more profitable than 13 colonies. Within a few decades, British newspapers were thanking Cort for making British manufacturers millionaires. The Royal Society announced modern civilization is due to cheap wrought iron, and we owe cheap wrought iron to Henry Cort. I knew Cort's patents well, but then I read an archaeological report of a foundry in Jamaica which was doing what Cort claimed to do with great success earlier than Cort, and that raised questions. I learned this foundry was run by 76 black metallurgists, described as perfect in every branch of metalworking, and I learned some of their names. Devonshire, Mingo, Mingo's son, Friday, Captain Jack, Matt, George, Jemmy, Jackson, Kofi and Kwasi. We know these men were enslaved and likely born in Africa, except Kwasi, who was likely of Akan heritage, but born in Jamaica and a Windward Maroon from a community of freedom fighters once led by the warrior Queen Nanny, who took chains and shackles and forged them into weapons, forcing the British to recognise their freedom in 1739.
I just wanted to briefly ask you if you've been able to find out where they might have learned about the art of making iron.
These metallurgists likely came from different civilizations across West and Central Africa, which were established ironworking civilizations, some of the most important in world history. But in the Jamaican foundry, they worked together to apply new African and Jamaican ideas to old European technology. And they bundled scrap iron like sugarcane, fed it through grooved rollers like those found in a sugar mill, and performed a kind of mechanical alchemy that turned scrap into high-value metal.
So what happened to these Jamaicans in the iron foundry?
By 1781, the innovation was turning a profit equivalent to £7.4 million sterling a year. And Cort first heard about this because he heard about a fight between Kwasi and another freedom fighter, Three Finger Jack, said to come from the Congo region. Cort was well connected. He'd been banker to the King of England's brother. Within a few months, he'd laid out massive sums of money. Jamaica was put under martial law, the foundry destroyed, and its machinery and equipment packed up and shipped to Portsmouth, England, where Cort operated. And it's possible some of the black metallurgists were also taken to Portsmouth, but we know Kwasi lived to a grand age, a respected captain of the Maroons.
Jenny Bulstrode, a lecturer from University College London, speaking to Victoria Uwanhunda. Some world-famous artists have been performing recently at the Festival Med in Portugal, including Amadou and Mariam. Known as the blind couple from Mali, Amadou lost his vision at the age of 16, while Mariam became blind at 5 as a consequence of untreated measles. But that hasn't stopped them from achieving great things, including being nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Contemporary World Music Album in 2008. The BBC's Koyel Basu caught up with them backstage.
I'm here from Festival Med, South Portugal. We are sat in a green room with Malian rock stars, husband and wife power duo Amadou and Mariam.
Bonjour.
I'm just going to dive right into the premise of your latest album, Eclipse, that you released late last year, which was based on a live sensory performance that you did in 2011 at the Manchester International Festival in complete darkness. Why was it done in darkness? What was it about it that was so special?
Because in Manchester, they supported the project. It was to make the people who came enter into the world of the blind, to know what it's like to listen to music without seeing, to help them understand how the blind appreciate music.
Les aveugles peuvent apprécier la musique.
Why did you choose to recreate this in an album? Why now, almost a decade later?
Each thing in time. Well, effectively, we had lots of projects, and we thought that it was necessary to release the recordings. It allowed us to speak about that, and people asked us for it too. So we did the performance about a decade before. And the fact of releasing the disc was about reliving that.
Le fait de faire ça maintenant en disque, ça fait revivre le passé.
Yes, because we'd also performed it at the Youth Institute for the Blind, and we could let people know what it's like for those who are blind. We met at the Youth Institute for the Blind. Me, I was a pupil there. When Amadou went there, it was me composing all the songs. I went there to learn the Braille system for the blind.
I was a musician. I had played in lots of orchestras. I went to the Institute for more education. And because they had a band, and they saw I was a guitarist and singer, I worked with them. I also taught music, so it's there we met. And it's there that we became friends. And we spoke so much about music. We did a tour of Mali. Then in 1986, we did a tour to the Ivory Coast. We moved to France in 1995. So it's from the late 1990s that we really started to perform our music in front of an international audience.
Malian husband and wife and super duo Amadou and Mariam, who were speaking to the BBC's Koyal Basu at Portugal's Festival Med. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Holly Palmer, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritz, and until next time, goodbye.
When your business travel is out of balance, you feel it. At National Car Rental, you're in control. Skip the counter, choose any car in the aisle, and manage your rental right from the app, so you can balance the boardroom with the not-so-board. Climb rocks after you rock your presentation, and mix work with leisure, or leisure with work. Find the perfect balance with National Car Rental. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.